What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? PolyTalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on PolyTalk.
Search up PolyTalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Liam Fox and welcome to Pacific Review. We'll take a look at the big stories from the region over the past week. Coming up, Samoa's only daily newspaper banned from covering senior members of the government. Solomon Island says it's open for business as it looks to attract more foreign investment. And priests from the Pacific fill gaps left by shrinking congregations in North Queensland. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This program is broadcast to you from the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people. First, one of the key features of this year's United Nations climate talks, known as COP30, has been protests on the streets of Belém in Brazil. Among the demonstrators are Pacific climate activists who've been working with indigenous Brazilians to demand stronger action from governments to reduce carbon emissions. For now, Fanua reports.
Thousands of people marched through the Brazilian city of Belém. Many of those marching were indigenous people from the Amazon who demanded a halt to mineral and energy operations in the Amazon jungle. Last week, dozens of indigenous Brazilian men stormed one of the COP30 venues and clashed with security. They were protesting against the Brazilian government's policy on logging, cattle farming and mineral extraction, and its impacts on their home, that being the Amazon forest. And they had the backing of Pacific Islanders.
The indigenous peoples of the Amazon are such incredible people. Their connection to land, water, is similar for us in the Pacific.
George Nadewa has worked closely with indigenous groups in Brazil. He's the Pacific regional organizer for 350.org, a climate action organization that has been at the fore of climate activism at COP meetings. Earlier this year in April, he was in Brazil to coordinate the signing of a letter with indigenous Brazilian activists calling for an urgent transition away from fossil fuels.
The struggles are the same, and it's one of survival. And this is such a good opportunity with COP. It's an opportunity for indigenous people that face the brunt of not only the climate crisis, but also human rights violation, to be at the forefront of these negotiations.
The Amazon rainforest covers over 7 million square kilometers of land in South America and has been dubbed by scientists as the lungs of the world. That's because it absorbs large amounts of carbon dioxide and releases oxygen, a critical function for mitigating the effects of fossil fuel emissions and the greenhouse gas effect. Living sustainably within this vast ecosystem are thousands of indigenous peoples whose way of life has changed little since their ancestors first arrived to South America more than 21,000 years ago. Most live a subsistent hunter-gatherer life in small villages, typically numbering no more than a few dozen people. In fact, many of them are still uncontacted by the developed world. But both illegal and state-sanctioned logging has threatened the livelihoods of these people, as well as the lungs of the world itself.
The impacts, whether from logging, are extremely harmful.
Toya Mancineri is the head of the coordination of the indigenous organizations of the Brazilian Amazon. She says indigenous peoples are at the forefront of combating the climate crisis.
Almost 80% of the world biodiversity is found in indigenous territories. We made a call for indigenous people of the Pacific to join this effort.
The link between indigenous peoples of the Pacific and the Amazon were strengthened earlier this year when the Forest Defender Camp was held in a remote village in the West Papua province of Indonesia. It saw the gathering of dozens of subsistent peoples from forests in Asia, the Pacific, Africa, and the Amazon.
Indigenous people are born with their knowledge from the ancestor who know best what to do for the future generation.
Papuan activist Francisca Rosari says the different groups talked about challenges their communities faced, like deforestation and the increasing occurrence of natural disasters.
We're trying at the end of the finalizations. For the first time, I think it's really complicated. Everyone wants to discuss about anything, what's the struggle and the issue.
At the conclusion of the Forest Defender Camp, the CIRA Declaration was signed. It called for the protection of tropical forests. With final climate negotiations underway in Belém, all eyes from the Pacific and from the Amazon are waiting for the final outcome.
Finau Fanua with that report. Samoa's new prime minister has banned the country's only daily newspaper from covering his press conferences, accusing it of publishing misleading articles. La'aulia Maliatoa Luatea Schmidt announced the ban on the Samoa Observer at his press conference after returning from 8 weeks' leave in New Zealand. In a later statement, the PM walked back the restriction, describing the ban as temporary. His announcement followed a confrontation at his private residence last weekend when the newspaper's editor, Shalveen Chand, claims he was assaulted by security officials. Mr. Chand is pursuing a police complaint and says he and his staff won't be deterred by the ban.
It may be a bit difficult getting him, but it doesn't really stop the work that we are trying to do, because we are trying to be the voice of the people and trying to highlight what the country needs. And we're also trying to hold the government to account as well. So the ban, yes, it may make things a bit more difficult, but it doesn't really put a stop to what we are trying to do.
The Prime Minister gave a list of reasons as to why he imposed the ban. But do you think it was actually in response to the confrontation at his home over the weekend?
I think it really all began when we started questioning the publication of a doctored image of him when he was meeting with the foreign minister of New Zealand, Winston Peters. Those questions remain to be unanswered, and he feels that we have tarnished his reputation by asking those questions. Well, he's the leader of the nation and he needs to answer to the people, and that's where we come in. We hold him to account and we ask those questions, whether he may like it or not. The thing was that he was away for 8 weeks and there was no real correspondence from him to the people of Samoa directly. He chose to speak to New Zealand-based social media broadcasters, which he favored. He spoke to them, but there was no real questions and answers. He made statements and there was this lack of communication. People did genuinely want to know how he is, how his health was. And that was the reason why we were there. We tried to make it to the airport, but we missed him because he was whisked away. And we just went there with a good intention to say, "Hi, PM, how are you? And how your treatment has been." There was no malice or anything to him or to dog him with serious questions. I guess he just didn't like it.
That confrontation, Shaveen, could you give us a breakdown of what actually took place?
My journalist, Manawi Faulalu, she was the one who went up to the gate and approached the police. And in her company was BBC journalist Dr. Mandeep Rai, who was actually doing a book on values all over the world. I arrived on the scene because Manawi had asked me to bring camera lenses. So I just came in to drop off the camera lenses. By the time I was walking back to my car, two unidentified men came out of the gate and straight away started to push me around. Had the door slammed onto my face. What was surprising was that even the police were present there. They did not do anything. I have filed an official complaint with the police, and I'm hopefully that they do their due diligence and do their investigations.
Did you feel it was necessary to approach the Prime Minister at his home?
Well, we have done it before. We have approached FIMA at a house, and if the need be, we approach any sort of minister at their home, because they're public figures and they work for the public and they should answer to the public. So if there are serious matters or matters that need to be highlighted, for example, a prime minister who is away for 8 weeks, just want to say, hi, prime minister, welcome back. Do you have anything to say to the people? If Albanese goes to the USA and he comes back, I'm sure journalists are waiting for him at the airport.
Shalveen Chand there, editor of the Samoa Observer, and he was talking to Aggie Tupou. The Solomon Islands government says it's making it easier for foreigners to do business in the country as it looks to attract more investment to boost economic growth to keep pace with a young and growing population. Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele told a business forum in Brisbane the private sector is central to his government's development agenda. Mr. Manele and his high-powered delegation pointed to the creation of special economic zones as proof of his government's commitment, though others say hurdles remain for foreigners wanting to invest in the country. Jeremiah Manele reckons there's never been a better time to do business in the Happy Isles.
We meet at a moment of opportunity. The global economy is shifting. New markets are opening. And in our region, we face both challenges and tremendous opportunities.
And he had a clear message for the delegates at the Australian Solomon Islands Business Forum in Brisbane.
He was central to unlocking our development agenda. Government cannot achieve its transformation agenda alone. It is through partnerships with businesses that we will create jobs, build firms, and generate prosperity.
Just how important business is to the country's development was outlined by the governor of the Solomon Islands Central Bank, Dr. Luke Farrow. He says economic growth has averaged around 3% per year for the last decade, but that's not enough.
We have a population growth rate of 2.4%. We need to grow at more than 5%. And if we do things differently and with your support, I'm sure, that will change the whole dynamics of growth.
Dr. Farrow says areas of business activity that will help boost economic growth include agriculture, resources, fisheries and tourism. He also highlighted the economic importance of the participation of Solomon Islanders in Australia's seasonal worker program, the PALM scheme, and the remittances they send home. While there have been complaints from other Pacific nations that the PALM scheme was causing local labour shortages and brain drains, Dr. Farrow says his country will happily supply more workers.
I view this as a brain gain for Solomon Islands. And in fact, I will encourage the Australian government to take more from Solomon Islands. If there's a brain drain in other neighbouring countries, come to the Solomons and take how many people you want to take, 100,000 or more.
At the forum, the Minister for Commerce, Industry, Labour and Immigration, Henry Kumar, outlined the two pillars of the government's investment strategy. One is the creation of a new statutory body, the Investment Promotion Agency.
Its establishment will allow it to streamline investor registration, approval and monitoring under one coordinated structure, empower the authority to undertake productive promotion, investor servicing and help aftercare, and strengthen compliance mechanisms to ensure consistent and transparent application of the law.
The other pillar, Mr. Kumar says, is the creation of special economic zones where businesses will be given tax incentives, help with infrastructure, and what he calls regulatory flexibility to attract quality investments.
The special economic zone strategy aims to encourage industrial diversification and regional economic development, promote export-oriented industries and value-added manufacturing, generate employment and skill development for local communities.
While senior members of the government were eager to spruik the country as an investment destination, there was a plea to do more to cut bureaucratic red tape. Accountant Greg Sojnocki specialises in helping foreigners set up shop in Solomon Islands. He says the time it takes to register a foreign investment has been reduced from forever to less than 3 weeks, but getting work permits to bring in expat staff remains a major headache. Mr. Sojnocki also half-jokingly warned would-be investors about Honiara's notoriously bad traffic which he says can impact business activity.
There's basically one road that goes from the airport all the way to the western side of the town, and it does lead to a lot of congestion and traffic, which impacts on investors and local people's ability to conduct business efficiently.
Honiara accountant Greg Sojnocki ending that report. Over the past 50 years, the number of Australians who identify as Christians has halved, leaving many communities without church leaders or services. In North Queensland, one diocese has turned to close neighbours to help fill gaps, with ministers from the Pacific now making up half of its full-time workforce. It's led to a unique blend of faith, culture and community, as Lucy Cooper reports.
It's a Sunday afternoon in Ayre, a rural town about an hour south of Townsville in North Queensland. In the All Saints Anglican Church, the stained glass windows are beaming from the glow of the sunset. But this isn't the average Australian church service. It's the monthly Melanesian service for the seasonal workers.
It's like we are creating a home or space, a safe space away from home, that they are free to come and share whatever the challenges that they are going through, and direct them to the right places that they can seek help.
That's Reverend Jeffrey Akwai. He moved from the Solomon Islands 3 years ago to serve as the priest of St. Paul's Anglican Church in Proserpine and the wider Whitsundays region.
We as Melanesians, islanders, we come in and we try to do what we could do in this context and continue to maintain the mission and ministry of the church wherever we are. So as Melanesians, wherever we go, we bring faith, community and culture with us.
The Melanesian service was established 4 years ago to provide a safe space for workers under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. John Mamarai from Solomon Islands is working in Ayre to earn money to support his family and build a home for them. He said the service makes him feel like he's back in Melanesia.
One important thing about it is to bring them together so that in the weekends we have Bible study on Saturdays, so that to bound them from going out to the clubs and the pubs and all those things, yeah, so that they can keep their money for their family.
Reverend Akwai isn't in Australia just to support Palm Scheme workers. He's helping fill a gap. Census data since 1971 showed the number of Australians who identify as Christian has halved from 86% to 44% in 2021.
It is really sad to see that the church here in Australia is going through a shortage of priests and people who should be there to lead the church. So we are so happy to come share the faith.
He was brought to Australia by the Bishop of North Queensland, Keith Joseph. All up, there are 11 ministers from the Solomon Islands, PNG and Vanuatu serving parishes across the diocese.
Together they make up half of my full-time workforce in the diocese.
He said without them, the diocese and the volunteer services it provides, op shops, support to aged care homes and pastoral care to seasonal workers, would collapse.
So you're looking at each parish providing between $200,000 and $1 million of volunteer labour into their communities each year. So all that would go if we didn't have them.
These Pacific priests are so valued by the community that a migration pathway was set up between the diocese and the Church of Melanesia. It's also somewhat of an ironic situation playing out across regional Australia, where religious leaders are recruited from countries that were converted by Christian missionaries from the West.
In the Pacific, you had some of the most rapid, like the quickest and the most enthusiastic uptake of Christianity. And it is really notable that Pacific Islands church authorities are taking leadership in the societies that used to send the missionaries.
That's Matt Tomlinson, an ANU professor of anthropology and director of the School of Culture, History and Language. He said it's hard to determine how Christianity reached the Pacific.
The answer is, on one hand, yeah, missionaries had to come and say, hey, there's something new. But a huge part of the story is Pacific Islanders saying, we're looking for something new and we're going to work with this in our terms.
Now in Australia, to account for dwindling numbers, Pacific Islanders are bringing their style of faith to churches across the country. Back in North Queensland, Reverend Jeffrey Akwai said faith is something that just can't be left behind.
Coming over here, it seems that we're living in two different contexts. And it's hard to live out your culture. It's always part of us.
He's grateful for the locals who attend the monthly services, welcoming the Melanesian expression of faith and musicality.
It kind of bring the local Parisians in as well. So usually we have a combined Melanesians and Australians coming in. And our friends here, they really enjoyed our worship as well. And they felt that they had been nourished by that singing and dancing way of worship that we bring with us.
Reverend Jeffrey Akwai, the priest of St. Paul's Anglican Church in Proserpine, ending that story from Lucy Cooper. Finally, to some sports and the pathways for the best young rugby league players in Fiji are set to grow over the next couple of years. The Kaiviti Silktails are poised to enter under-17 and under-19 teams to sit alongside their under-21s in the New South Wales NRL's age group competitions. As Richard Hewitt reports, the move comes after the national men's coach bemoaned the lack of development programs after the Fiji Bati's heavy defeat to the PNG Kumuls in the recent Pacific Championships.
Puller dummy half, working the right-hand side, follow me, and he goes over. Too little too late, if you like, but that's a consolation try there for Fiji.
Too little too late indeed, as the Mbati slipped to a 32-point loss against the Kumuls, prompting this response from Fiji's coach, Wise Kativarata.
To grow the game and make the game better, especially with the PNG, the brothers here got a team. To me personally, I think we should have a New South Wales Cup team with hunters to feed the Papua New Guinea chief. It's important that we work together, not only grow Papua New Guinea, but grow in Fiji too. Because no one else will do it, we might as well do it also. We can help each other on that, like bringing the under-17, under-19 team to come and play against your boys. You know, from us, if you look at Fiji Rugby League, they don't have a system, a pathway. Lucky enough, Papua New Guinea got a pathway already with hunters, but we don't. We start doing it now from the last 2 years. We start putting together a system, a pathway that we can well recognize in the NRL system.
Right now, the word is that Kativarata may not be in post for much longer, but that's a matter for the FNRL. However, the questions he raised about development pathways in Fiji came as something of a surprise to his friend and chief executive of the Kaiviti Silktails, Steve Driscoll.
Surprising, but at the same time, you know, it's press conference after a pretty big loss and probably a good way to divert the conversation. But I believe he was on the phone to our coach talking about some players that he wanted to bring into our team. So I think it was probably more of a play for FNRL. But yeah, look, it's obviously it was an opportunity while they were there with PNG and look at potentially forming some sort of partnership with them. I know that was a lot of what his conversation was about. We'll see what happens.
In the meantime, the Silktails have plenty to build on after registering 4 wins in New South Wales under-21 competition in 2025, including a notable victory over the eventual premiers, Melbourne Storm. And as the Silktails head into 2026 and their third season in the Jersey Flag Cup, the board are keeping faith with the man who led them to that landmark win over the Storm. And next time round, Steve Driscoll says they'll be aiming for finals.
We've just extended our current coach, Tomoli Duve, who took on the caretaker role in 24, and he had his first full season last year. And you know, we went from 0 wins to 13 points, and we're really, really happy with what we have there. And he's a local guy as well, which for us is even more important. And the FNRL, look, we've taken on a heap of initiatives this year to assist them. We've hosted them for different test matches this year that they played as curtain raisers and on the other side of our game. So the relationship is good from what I see. We've had a couple of players that were in the squad this year for the Butty, which was great.
And now the Silktails plan to forge ahead with establishing an under-19 side that will play around half a dozen development games next year, with the aim of joining the New South Wales age group competition in 2027 alongside an under-17 team in their competition as well. And while some critics have characterised the Silktails as a private entity in Australian hands, Steve Driscoll says they are all about growing the game in Fiji.
Our players are 100% local. Our staffing, apart from the board members and one consultant, is all local. So if that is the feeling, probably is frustrating. But the priority for us now is to get our under-19s program in action this year, and then in 27, having our 17s and 19s participate in those junior representative competitions. And the other part too, we've just had six guys exit out of the program to play with the SG Ball with the Bulldogs next year. And there's three guys that have aged out of the program that are training currently with the Bulldogs New South Wales Cup squad. That's all really exciting as well.
And there could be more excitement to come, because once the age group teams are bedded in, the prospect of a Fijian team in the senior competition, the New South Wales Cup, would be back on the agenda. No doubt with the Silktails chairman, Petro Thivonetheva, leading the charge.
Richard Hewitt reporting there. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific. Once again, Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people.